masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. Until we've thoroughly tested every last close-chested view, find the more you think you know, the less you really do. Where would we be without THC? We know the lying to us, just don't know to what degree. Where would we be without THC? The highest side chat show. Greg Carwood and Company.
Side chatters, if you dig into the paranormal at all, it doesn't take long to realize that thousands of people have had encounters or experiences with strange humanoid creatures that just aren't getting treated very seriously in mainstream culture, to the point that it almost seems like we have some sort of collective denial for what is surely a crucial element of our reality. And it seems like a perfect storm of carefully crafted social engineering, egoic arrogance, and the sheer terror of true acceptance have set back our study of this strangeness in our human terrarium to troubling degrees. And as if little blue, green, gray biological beings coming in the night wasn't enough, a study of these cases finds a few other odd commonalities amongst the experiencers that we would be wise to consider. Invasive medical and sexual procedures, teleportation to foreign crafts, multi-generational visitations, missing time, prophetic dreams, implants, shape-shifting, memory distortion, meditative states, military involvement, telepathic messages that it's all gonna be okay, and maybe even a connection to the state of being that we call death. Well, one of the most famous cases of being taken by the visitors comes from today's guest, Whitley Strieber, detailed in his 1987 New York Times bestseller, Communion, a name and a title that I'm sure most of us here are well familiar with. On top of writing many highly acclaimed fiction books and hosting the popular Dreamland podcast, Whitley has also followed up on the Communion saga regularly with a string of books that outlines each new level of understanding, with titles like Transformation, Breakthrough, The Next Steps, The Secret School, The Communion Letters, Solving the Communion Enigma, and several others. And after decades of defending himself against the big machine, taking lie detector tests and brain scans, facing the ridicule of the uninitiated, and constantly having to beat back the persistent narrative that these visitors are just aliens from outer space, he has emerged with a new forward-thinking perspective in his latest book, The Afterlife Revolution, which was co-written by his late wife Anne from across the River Styx. See, Anne passed away in 2015, but due to the strengthening of her soul in life, her determination to investigate the big questions, and with the foundation of a protocol established years prior between Whitley and herself, she has provided great insight about the after-death experience and the curious visitors Whitley and thousands of others have experienced, and the result is an emotional and informative ride through a unique book co-written between both sides of the veil. And it's a true honor and a pleasure to have him here today, investigating this weird world longer than I've been alive, a gifted child of the secret school, the Little Green Men guru, the only THC guest to have been played by Christopher Walken in a major motion picture, and now the ambassador of the afterlife, Whitley Strieber. Welcome to the Higher Side.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for that extraordinary introduction. You know, I am still alive, too, surprisingly enough, despite my rapidly advancing age. When you get to my age, every year is actually about three. So every time you look around, you're 3 or 4 years older than you were the last time you looked. It's interesting.
Yes, I think that would be.
We don't realize it when we're in the middle of life and time seems kind of eternal, but it sort of comes to a climax and you feel it. But I love it. It's been an extraordinary life, and I am reasonably content with that, although I have been beaten up a good bit. I will agree to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate that insight. Another thing I'll just have to file away from my future self, but this is a real treat. I'm a big fan. I've always liked the more nuanced ideas you put forth about the visitors, as you've called them. And your latest book really does push the envelope by folding these experiences in with the afterlife. I would like to think most of the people out there are familiar with your communion story. So maybe we could start by learning a bit more about Anne and her life, about how she thought about these encounters, and some of the logistics of writing a book with her post-death. How does that sound?
Yeah, we can do that. Take it where you want to take it.
Sure. Well, give us a little context for Anne, because in her life, she studied the visitor situation quite a lot. She strengthened her soul, as you say in the book. What else would you say to the people so they can maybe get a feel for why Anne would be a perfect person to be able to reach back post-death?
Well, yeah, Anne was she became an expert on the soul. One of the most basic truths about Western society is that in escaping from the 1,000-year religious dictatorship that started with the Council of Nicaea and gradually ended after the rediscovery of Lucretius' long poem on the nature of things, which advocated a secular approach to reality, we abandoned and threw out the soul along with all of the religious stuff that had become attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, religion was all about the soul. The religious dictatorship was about people trying to gain power over other and doing so by claiming to know what their souls needed in order to persist and to grow after life. This is a sort of disaster because we're in a situation now where we deny the existence of the soul out of fear that if we don't, the old religious dictatorship, which waits in the wings and we can see it hovering around us in the form of fundamentalist Muslims, fundamentalist Hindus, fundamentalist Christians, fundamentalist everything, they're waiting to retake the high ground and reestablish religion and belief as the center of human culture, which it has finally gotten free of. So where did we end up? Annie understood all of this. I'm actually repeating ideas that came from her. After she died, I'm going to jump forward just for a second, and then I'm going to jump back. After she died, one of the most important things that she said was, the human species is too young to have beliefs. We are about the question. And that is so important because it goes right down to the absolute core of reality, the nature of reality. When you get down below the level of the particle, it becomes indeterminate. The universe is basically indeterminate. And until we understand why that is and why it is that attention itself seems to be what organizes reality into something that can be seen and touched and interacted with, we can't have beliefs. Because without a core understanding there, we're always on slippery ground. Now, why was she such an expert? Well, part of it probably rests in who she was when she came into this world. I don't know that. She has shown me a wall full of pictures of people in various forms of dress that looked big. In other words, there were lots of portraits, and whether those were portraits of who she has been in the past or not, I don't know. She didn't say. In any case, in this life, here's what happened. First, we met, and we can go into that later as to how it is that no sooner had we met than the strange stuff started to happen way before the communion experience. It started within months of our having married, actually, even before that. In any case, along comes the communion experience. I'm scared to death. I don't want to tell her what happened. I didn't tell her anything for weeks. And I went to the doctor and went through the whole, what happened was I had a close encounter of the third kind, and it came into a life where I would assume that such a thing would only happen to yokels in the woods and not to a man with a reasonable amount of education like me. And you made reference to the ego. I was living in the ego of Western culture at the time. So I would just dismiss something like that as a joke. Except the problem was, after ruling out every conceivable possibility other than a close encounter, I was forced to come face to face with what to me remains to this day a very enigmatic experience. I'm not an advocate for alien belief in aliens, as you know. I am an advocate for exploration of that question, though.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, I finally told Anne. And Anne was a brilliant person. She was the most brilliant person I ever knew. She had a very large-scale mind, and it was a remarkable mind, a very original mind, too. So I thought, oh my, I've got to tell her. I have no choice. I can't not tell her. She knows that I've been in an emotional tailspin for weeks. She knows something is terribly wrong, and I don't have the right not to tell my wife. So I told her what I remembered, expecting her to say, well, we've got to talk about this, and maybe you should see a psychiatrist, but if you can't get past this, we're going to have to rethink this whole marriage. Because she was raising a little boy at the time, and she might not want her child exposed to someone who had such crazy beliefs. I would understand that perfectly. I wouldn't either.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, she said, oh, thank God. I thought you were losing your mind. He could not have been farther from what I expected to hear. And I thought, what? And from that day to this, it has always seemed as if she was simply ready for this and she could handle it. She took over the intellectual side of everything. I was going to call communion body terror because it scared me so deeply and so viscerally. My physical body became fear itself. But she said, no, that's not what it's about. You'll find out eventually what it's about. And I said, well, what is it about? And she said, it's communion, communion. And I thought to myself, well, that seems pretty far from where I am right now. But it was the truth. And that is what it became over the years. It took a long time to go from being a frightened outsider being dragged into this by my hair to being what I am today, which is a participant in a blessed awakening, ours. Anyway, one day, Annie, she helped in the writing of the book immeasurably. The book's name and the group of questions that are the centerpiece of the text are all from Anne. Then we began to get letters, tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of letters over a long period of time, and Anne took this over completely. The mailmen were bringing them in great big mail bags and dumping them on the living room floor. She hired a secretary, and she had her own way of doing everything. She was a complete original. Here's how the secretary came along. She said to me, I need a secretary. I said, I know you do. Just to open the letters took time. This is before email. And I said, let's call manpower. And she said, no, I don't want to call manpower. I'm going to find my secretary in these letters. And I thought, well, that's not going to be practical. Where's the secretary going to be? In Cincinnati, in Australia? A few minutes later, she said, here, take a look at this letter. And I read the letter, and the woman was saying she was a singer and an actress. I said, well, she says here she's a singer and an actress. And said, have you ever heard of her? I said, no, I haven't. She said, well, then that's not all she is, or she'd be starving to death. Look at that handwriting. That's the work of a professional. And she lived across the street from us in Manhattan, 3 minutes from our apartment. And she had had extensive experiences in her lifetime. incredible experiences. Her name is Laurie Barnes, and she became Ann's secretary, was her secretary for 15 years. That's the way Ann worked and thought. Incredibly efficient, completely original. One day she came out of her office and she said, "Whitley, this has something to do with what we call death." Thus beginning the real journey that comes down over the years to where we are now, the afterlife revolution with this remarkable soul on the other side, very efficiently and cleverly making her presence known in ways that people schooled in Western secular culture can reasonably entertain as being possible. In other words, a spiritual genius. And not only that, an actual intellectual genius as well. A little woman we met in a computer dating program, and it was the most incredible piece of luck I can ever imagine having in my life. I don't think my life would have unfolded in any way like this if Anne had not come into it.
Wow, that is some great context for sure. And I wanted to ask you about those communication mechanisms now that she has passed and you're working on this latest book. You mentioned working with mediums under some pretty strict conditions that I think should impress even the most skeptical out there. Could you elaborate on that process of communication and the results you've gotten?
Yeah, here's how it happened. Annie passed away on August the 11th, 2015, at 7:45 at night. It was the most devastating moment I can imagine of my life or any life. This woman who had been my life, who I was in an orbit around her. People all thought, "Oh, well, she's in orbit around him." No. I was in orbit around her. And when she went, suddenly the sun that rose in my sky was gone. And I lay beside her body in the bed, thinking, now what? It felt like she was completely gone, because she was a very extraordinary person. And something happened when the moment of death. I've been with people who've died before. There's a stillness that comes into the body, but it doesn't become unrecognizable. And Annie became immediately unrecognizable. It was like she was made entirely of light, and as soon as she left, the whole thing just was gone. It was appalling. I never saw anything like it in my life. So then I went into the living room, and I was just sitting there. I had been there for about an hour. My kids were leaving me be. They came and got Annie and took her away, and undertakers did. And I was sitting there and thinking, what happens now to me? Annie, are you really gone? You feel so gone. You feel so gone. The phone rang about 9:30, and it was a friend, Belle Fuller. And Belle said, "Whitley, I just had the strangest experience. I heard Ann tell me to call you. Is she all right?" She knew Ann was sick, but she didn't know she had died. I said, "Ann died an hour and a half ago, Belle." We talked for a moment, and I hung up. Little did I know what was really happening. Little did I know. A few days later, my kids had taken me out to Palm Springs just to get away from the house for a weekend. I don't have much money, so it was a relief to be able to, I couldn't have afforded it myself, but they paid. And, someone is beat up as much as I am. I don't get reviewed in the New York Times or anything anymore. My life is being punished for being me. That's what it is. I am an outsider, an advocate for rejected knowledge, and at best a joke. In any case, let's go back to the more interesting stuff. I was sitting on a bench in the mountains above Palm Springs, and I was thinking to myself, Annie, do you exist? Is there an afterlife at all? I'd had so much experience of this. You understand? I mean, if you read Solving the Communion Enigma or Supernatural, you'll read about all of the incredible interactions with the dead I'd already had. But you lose your confidence when it's this close, believe you me.
Mm-hmm.
The phone rang again. Out in the mountains, I mean, I was not even near any cell towers. There was a slight signal. It wasn't a supernatural phone ring. Let me emphasize that. It was Claire Henry, William Henry's wife. William Henry is a good friend and also a searcher, and as is Claire. And you can find him often on Ancient Aliens, actually. And he used to have a show on Unknown Country on my website called Revelations. Anyway, Claire is an absolutely lovely Englishwoman, a deep journeyer in the spirit. And she said, Whitley, I just had the strangest thing happen. I heard Anne's voice tell me to call you. She knew, of course, by then that Anne was dead. And I thought to myself, how strange. This is the second time this has happened. I was asking to hear from Anne, and it happened. And then a few days later, it happened again. At some point, I recall, or I think I recall, back in the 90s when we realized that the close encounter experience and interaction and contact with the dead were all connected. In fact, that may be the only thing the close encounter experience really is. I don't know. What we call the dead, or as Annie put it, something else. In any case, we had decided that the first of us to go would try to contact the other, but indirectly through friends, because both of us would immediately assume that it was just imagination otherwise. And I thought to myself, my God, she's doing it. She's doing what we agreed to do. I'm not absolutely sure about this. I always like people to understand the level of confidence. I'm pretty sure we had this conversation, but it was so brief, and it was so long ago, I can't say I remember it word for word. But I do remember that we had decided to do something like this. And I began to take notice. And then there followed a deepening of my relationship with her and with the visitors that started in the following manner. Do you want to ask another question, or shall I just go on?
Feel free to continue. Yeah, this is great.
Okay, I will continue. You can have a cup of coffee with your listeners. Anyway. Okay, fast forward a few weeks. It's now September of 2015, and I decided to go to Nashville. William Henry was having an event at the Scarrett Bennett Center in Nashville, which is a lovely place. We used to have something called the Dreamland Festival, and we would meet there. So it had a lot of very, very beloved associations for me. And I decided I would go. And I went, and I love listening to William and watching him work, because everything he does is through art, through paintings. And he shows beautiful images of Renaissance and pre-Renaissance painting art, and talks about it in terms of transformation and the rainbow body, as it's called. So I was there, and during one of the breaks, a lady came up to me and said, Mr. Strieber, I have something I would like to tell you, and it's a little strange, and I'm not sure quite how to go about this. And I thought, well, don't worry. I mean, you know, you don't have to worry about telling me anything strange. And so I said something to that effect. You can tell me anything strange. I've heard it all. But if this is stranger than anything I've ever heard, I'll be both amazed and grateful. And she said, well, I just heard Anne. She knew Anne's voice from the radio and from having been in presentations with us. Say very clearly in my ear, tell Whitley that I can see him when he's in the chair. This had an immediate and huge effect on me. I knew at once what was meant. I sit in a chair when I meditate because I ruined one of my knees when Annie was ill because I lifted her a lot because she had lost the use of her left side toward the end. In any case, I thought, my God, I know this. And my mind went back years to the early days of the Close Encounter experience when I had asked during one of the few interactions I ever had, I had very few give and takes with them, why they had come. And the answer was, we saw a glow. And at the time, I thought that must have meant the glow of cities and so forth, because I was fairly invested in the alien hypothesis early on. But then I realized, no, it's not that glow. And I know what this is now. As soon as the woman spoke, it seemed that the information came with the words she said about Anne. It is a glow that is set up when you do something called the sensing exercise. What you do is you place your attention on your physical sensation and let your thoughts run on their own. And this causes an intensification of the energy in the nerves that are in the surface of the skin, which are like an electromagnetic organ. We don't think of them as an organ, but it is. It's literally a non-physical organ, an electromagnetic organ that resides just above the surface of our body. And when you get an EKG or something, an EEG, that's what they're measuring, is that electricity. It changes the nature of that electricity to pay attention to the sensation it is producing. And in another level of reality, that can be seen as an increasing glow. I am quite sure that this is it. And I've been doing the sensing exercise since 1970. And in the early days when we moved out to our cabin in upstate New York, all of a sudden these visitors who were cruising around there, the huge Hudson Valley UFO flap was taking place a few miles away. I didn't even know about it at the time, but it was taking place a few miles away. So they were definitely around big time. And they must have seen at night, we were there alone in the cabin with no houses around us in a very isolated, fairly isolated spot. It wasn't like the only cabin for miles and miles. There are other cabins around, but there was one little glow that showed up every night at about 11. And they got curious and came to see what was going on. Now, fast forward to September of 2015. I went home from that conference knowing something very valuable. The dead can see us when we do the sensing exercise. It opens a door into another reality. I hadn't been home for a week before suddenly at 3 o'clock in the morning, something electrified one of my toes. And I jumped out of bed because I felt that. And I thought, have I got gout? But it wasn't gout. It just went away. So I went back to sleep. The next night, it was more obvious. Someone who I could not see, and the visitors are often around me, and I rarely see them. So that's not unusual. And if people think, oh, well, that's weird. It's not so weird. If you look closely at the report of the UFO that was released by the U.S. Navy in December, it mentions that the object was apparently able to cloak itself and become invisible. They can do that on an individual basis as well, and they're really very accomplished at it. In any case, someone grabs my right nipple, I'm lying on the right side of the bed, and shakes that nipple hard. I leaped out of the bed. Because, you know, I mean, I'm alone in an apartment, right?
Right.
It's the middle of the night and someone has grabbed my nipple and is pinching the dickens out of it. I am going to be extremely concerned. So I jump up and there's nobody there. And I think to myself, well, there is somebody here because that didn't just happen. I've had lots of experience with these beings when they're invisible. On rare occasions, I've gotten them to become visible. I've gotten them willing to do that briefly. Anyway, I thought to myself, it's the same time, it's three, and I remembered back to the mid-90s when I was meditating with a group of people who claimed to be from the Bardo Between the Lives, who would come into our meditation room in our cabin at 11, and then they would wake me up at 3 by punching me on the shoulder, and I would go in and meditate with them again. And I thought to myself, now I understand why. Because at 3, everybody is asleep. There's very little going on. There's not a lot of energy anywhere. And when you sit and you do the sensing exercise, you're easy to see. And it's easy for Annie to find me at this hour. And that's why they want it. Since then, I have done it every night I possibly could at 3, as well as 11. And in fact, last night I did it at 1:30, and they woke me up at 3, and I didn't get up to do it a second time because I'd already done it. But that is how it goes. And the way they wake me up now is always the same. They will blow on the back of my hand or blow in my face, usually blow in my face. And it's interesting. It doesn't feel like someone blowing. It's like a directed column of air, where only that column of air, when somebody blows on you, the center of the breath is the strongest part, but it doesn't have a laser-like sense to it that it does when they blow on me. And it's very much like a discrete column of air is projected into my face or onto the back of my hand. And then I get up immediately and meditate. And they have a lot of other ways of communicating with me. And they are here. I suppose Annie is part of this. I don't know. But I have gone from being a terrified and unwilling little animal to being a participant in this experience in the deepest communion that I can find in myself. And that is where I am now. A rather long answer to a short question, but there you have it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that paints such a great picture of how you were able to open up those lines of communication and, you know, how these visitors have been interacting with you since that fateful day in 1985. And, you know, reading this book, Anne has so much to say about the other side, and that's really fascinating. Can you tell us about some of the things she's been able to communicate with you about the shape and structure of the afterlife and maybe what these visitors' role is in it?
Well, in terms of the shape and structure, I don't have a real sense of that. Some of the things that Anne has said are things like, we are light alive, which was a very powerful statement to me. I understood it immediately. And I understood why it is we can't see them, or usually can't see them, because they're in a sense at a different speed than we are. They may be here in the room, but they're not visible to us because the speed of the light that they are is somehow different. It's not like regular light. There's something else going on here that we have not yet understood. And by the way, we have in our history of science a trap. The trap is that we have a tendency to say the only things that exist are the things that we can measure now. That does not happen to be true. It has never been true. But in the middle of the 18th century, before meteors were discovered, scientists would confidently say rocks cannot fall from the sky. And when fossils were found and brought to Voltaire, he said those are merely fish bones thrown aside by travelers. Later, of course, much larger fossils were found and the fish bone story died. But the point is that we have a tendency to close our minds to anything that we haven't already discovered. This is a property of light that we haven't discovered. It is what the master of the key who I met in 1999 called conscious energy. It is what they are now. I'm pretty sure, though, that there's even more to it than that. I'm pretty sure there are parallel universes, and I've had a few experiences and know of a few experiences that would suggest that there are other physical universes right here. I'll give you an example. There is in my family a country house in Texas, and it's been in the family for 5 generations, for a long time, I guess 6 generations. And it is situated on a bluff, and immediately north of the house, there's an empty area, which there have been a lot of things on that over the years, tennis court and different things. And one morning, 2 people who were in the house, not me, walked out onto the front porch, and to their amazement, saw another house, a different architecture and a different type of house on that area, which is usually empty. And there was no tennis court at the time, so it was just an open area. And it was as big as life and completely real as far as they were concerned. They rushed back into the house to call everybody to come see this thing because it had come out of nowhere. Everyone knew that there was nothing there. There'd been nothing there the day before. There'd never been anything there. But when they went back out, it was gone.
Hmm.
Now, fast forward to a year ago, April. I was in the house. It was night. It was dark. I was attending a reading group that I'm in here in California, in Malibu. And I was attending it via FaceTime. So the room was dark, and I was looking into the screen on my cell phone when I noticed movement in the shadows. I was in the middle of a big, dark living room, and I was shocked. I moved the cell phone aside to see a boy of looked like about 12 to 14 wearing a tunic-type shirt and loose pants, and the shirt was raw linen with black piping down it. It wasn't a style that anything that you would normally see on somebody. And he stood not 3 feet away from me and was watching me. And I looked directly into his eyes. There was eye contact between us. And I could literally see the moment that he realized that I could see him. I could see a look of surprise and concern come over his face, and he disappeared. I think that there is a parallel universe, and this is a wonderful house, by the way. It's full of ghosts, and they're charming ghosts. I'll tell you a ghost story from the house.
Sure.
One of my cousins, I have some cousins, they're girls. And they were in the house when they were teenagers, one in one room and one in another. And they were, of course, being teenagers, they were rather touchy about each other. And one of them woke up in the night because there was movement in her room, and she looked, and the other one was sitting at her dresser brushing her long blonde hair. And in the next morning at breakfast, the girl who had seen this said to her sister, "Don't come in my room and brush your hair in the middle of the night anymore. You woke me up." Whereupon the sister said, "I didn't do that. I never went in your room. I would never go in your room. Blah, blah, blah." My grandmother was there, and she said, "Oh, that was Rudy Toot Toot." And the kid said, "Who's Rudy Toot Toot?" She said, "Well, in your great-grandmother's day, when the house was new, she used to have a lot of artists and movie people and opera singers and stuff up. And one of them was an opera singer who used to come and overstay her invitation chronically. She would be asked for a weekend and come and stay 2 weeks. And nothing has changed in this house. This house is the same as it was when it was built. The furniture is mostly all the same. Or things that have worn out have been closely copied. So if you look at a picture of this house from 1910 and a picture of the living room taken yesterday, you can see everything is the same. So we're weird that way. In any case, this opera singer would sit there in front of that very dresser that you saw her sitting in front of and brush her long blonde hair and sing opera. And it drove the boys crazy, and they called her Rudy Toot Toot. And Rudy Toot Toot, after she died, was seen there many times and less often recently. And this happened back in the 60s. And that is, as far as I know, the last time Rudy Toot Toot ever came to that house. But she obviously liked it very much. And I could tell you, I could spend the entire morning telling you ghost stories about that house. And it is, however, a house of happy ghosts.
Nice.
We have never had a ghost in there that was mean or ominous or scary at all. But we all have plenty of experience with ghosts in that house.
Yeah, that's a great story. And it makes me think the next owner of the house is going to see you deep in trance in that chair of yours at the right times of day.
Oh, this house is going to be in the family forever. We're never selling this.
Fair enough.
I'm not in a direct line to inherit it, but the people who do inherit it have no intention of ever selling it. It will never be sold. It's part of the family's blood.
That's great to have. Rare these days.
Yeah, rare, but it's an old and close family. There's a lot of love in this family, and there has been. And we've had plenty of fights. Two members of the family ended up in front of the Supreme Court one time, because when we do fight, we tend to fight hard.
Hmm.
But nevertheless, they're friends again. One of them won and one of them lost is what this tends to happen in front of the Supreme Court.
Yes, indeed.
But they're friends again, and we go on.
We do.
Down the generations.
So let me ask you this question, because you mentioned fear a little bit earlier, and I wanted to ask you about these beings, the visitors, and their relationship with fear, because I've had a few friends describe their encounters, and they say that they sometimes awaken in the night with sleep paralysis. Then they can see these beings sort of out of the corner of their eye. And then when their fear is at its height, that's when these shadow figures tend to descend on them. And I've heard you mention in the past that their appearance can get more menacing as the fear level goes up, almost like a shapeshift. What do you think is the mechanism behind this fear relationship? Are they feeding on it?
No, not at all. They're reflecting it. And just like any animal does, if you show fear in front of another creature, another animal, that animal will react with fear or menace, one of the two.
Hmm.
Now I'm shifting from talking about the world of souls and to the world of the visitors. They don't have, apparently, the barrier between the living and the dead that we do. That's a fundamental difference, but I think they may still not be from here. It becomes a very complicated situation because we have what we call the dead, and we have the visitors who are both physical and non-physical, and we're getting kind of mixed up as to what in the heck's going on because it's not really very clear. In any case, talking about them as physical beings, I can give you some extremely specific examples of how this works. First, just going back to the sleep paralysis thing, those may not be close encounter experiences. Sleep paralysis works like that, and there's no clear evidence that sleep paralysis is part of the close encounter experience at all. Hmm. I never had it. I never experienced anything like sleep paralysis in my, maybe once or twice, but I didn't relate it to my close encounters. In any case, here's an example. One of the things that Annie was very skilled at doing was getting people up at the cabin who would encounter the visitors at the cabin. I don't know how she did it. She just seemed to have an instinct for it. It usually worked. It didn't always, but it usually did. One night, this was the situation. A lady named Raven Dana was in one bedroom. In the bedroom beside her was Laurie Barnes, Ann's secretary. And in the living room, there was a couple who were filmmakers. By the way, you'll notice I mention witnesses by name consistently through these conversations, as I do as much as possible in my books. The reason is that I am making extraordinary claims, and anything I can do to substantiate those claims, not to prove them, but to allow people to believe they have reason to entertain them as a possibility and to explore them in question, I will do. That's why you know, if you pick up a lot of these books, there's long stories, but there's never any corroboration. But I try to get as much in that as I can. And these are all witnesses I'm mentioning by name who have given me permission to do so. Okay, so that said, let's go on. Here's what happens. First of all, Annie knew that the visitors were going to show up that night. And the reason she did was this. Laurie Barnes had been walking on the road in front of the cabin, and she had encountered her brother, which very much surprised her because he had disappeared 20 years before and been declared dead by the FBI. And she said to him, "My God, I'm so glad to see you again. Come down to the cabin and meet my friends." And he said, "I just wanted to let you know that I'm all right." And he smiled at her, rose from the ground, and sort of drifted back into the woods and was gone. She came back from her walk in a state of complete shock and amazement. And he said to me quietly, "They'll show up tonight." I said, "I know it." Because often the dead are associated with their appearance in various ways. That night, here's what happened. Raven Dana was awakened by someone tapping on her shoulder. I believe she may have been awakened by someone moving on the bed. I don't have the narrative in front of me. In any case, she opened her eyes and she thought, "It's a raccoon," because it had great big black eyes. And then she thought, "Well, no, it can't be a raccoon because it would have come in through the window, and the windows are screwed shut. Oh, my God, it's one of them."
Hmm.
And she heard it say, "What can I do for you?" To which she replied, "You could walk down that hall." And it held out its hand, and they touched hands. And I was with Raven about 6 weeks ago, and I asked her about the experience and how she remembered it. And she said, "Well, you know, Whitley, there are two experiences in my life that are as vivid right now as they were when they happened. The first is the day my mother died, and the second is that experience." That's how powerful it was to her and is. So anyway, after touching her hand, it moved out into the hallway. And the reason she had said that was there was a low-light camera set up on the hall by the filmmaker couple who were in the living room sleeping on the couch. The being went down the hall and proceeded to wake up Laurie Barnes and another woman who did not wish her name used in the next bedroom and interacted with them for a few moments as well. There was never anything found on the tape. We looked and looked and looked. However, toward dawn, the filmmaker woke up because he saw, looking down at him from the bedside, a little man with a huge head. And he was a Hollywood filmmaker, deeply invested in the secular society overlaid by the cynical culture of Hollywood. So he was there to make money. He had no idea about any of this being in any way real. So he was shocked and terrified by what he saw. Now, this is what I've been leading up to. He observed this man turn into something that had the head of a hawk. It reacted to his fear with a defensive response by becoming menacing. And this is because we are not tamed to each other. We are socialized. Human beings are deeply socialized. We live in big herds, but, you know, cattle are comfortable in their herd. But you take a cow out of the herd and try to interact with it, it's not going to be so comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
We're the same way. We are not tamed to them, and they are not tamed to us either. So when one side gets scared, the other side is going to react with fear too. I got over this. I am tamed to them now, and the ones who come to me are fairly well tamed to me. But it's not true of others. I'll give you another example, and this is just from a few weeks ago. I was at a conference. I am often invited to these conferences of scientists and academics who are studying people with unusual experiences. And you understand, I don't talk about this, but I've had brain scans. I've been deeply and profoundly analyzed. So there's no real question about the veracity of what I am talking about. There are things about me physically, including an implant in my left ear, that speak to the authenticity, at least, of the experience, if not to its actual meaning and sense. Mm-hmm. In any case, I was at this conference, and I was describing experiences and so forth, like I always do. And I was with one of the other conferees in the same bedroom at night, in the same dorm room, shared rooms in this conference center. So we had separate beds. And the visitors often show up in my life at night. Could be Anne, for all I know. I'm not sure. In any case, one of them showed up beside the bed. I actually glimpsed it briefly, very unusually. And I was quite frightened by its eyes, which were very dark and deep. And then it blew on my left hand, or sent a column of air onto the back of my left hand, causing me to turn away. So I did not experience any more of the dynamic of that, which I've had before, which is it's like looking into infinity. It's surprisingly difficult to do. It wasn't frightening, but it was extremely unsettling. And then there was a brief interaction. I got up and meditated and did the sensing exercise. Meanwhile, my roommate had an awareness of the presence of this being, and he heard inside his body another voice, another part of him say, "Oh my God." And I know why that happened. I know where that fear originated from and why it existed. But what I will say about it now is that it is a sample of just how visceral and how very deep this fear is. You have to come to peace with your own reality and your own mortality in order to interact with this. The process of taming yourself to this is not simply a matter of propinquity and being with them a lot. It is a matter of coming to a sense of deep inner peace with who and what you are. And that is a journey. It's a soul journey of major proportions. Mm-hmm. So this is some of the things about the fear. And now we have a big folklore that elaborates on these fears and makes them into beings. And soon we have all kinds of folkloric beings running around with terrible ideas, and then reinforced by the core belief that I think is central to the Air Force's reaction to this presence, is that they're demons because they've been going after them and shooting after them and so forth for years. So you've got all of that too, quite a bit to overcome. But nevertheless, that's the way things are. You know, there's nothing we can do about it. Mm-hmm. It is what it is. As far as taming yourself to it, it's an inner practice, a soul practice, and a matter of acceptance. And I just want to have a footnote here. I mentioned that the eyes were particularly difficult to look into, and they are, because there's a sense of infinity there that's shocking when you see it. The week later, I had told this story, and the two of us had talked about it all through the conference, of course, because for him it was a big experience. It was the first time he'd ever had a direct experience like that. And I had talked about the eyes being frightening and so forth and so on. Hmm. The next week, presumably the same visitor showed up during my meditation very briefly for maybe 3 seconds. But what was prominent on his face was a pair of dark glasses. As if he was saying, joking and saying, okay, if my eyes are too scary, I'll wear dark glasses. And that's where our relationship is now. In other words, it's not like it used to be. It's much more comprehensible and much more fun, actually.
Hmm.
I'm having fun with this.
Well, that's great because, you know, when I hear about the early story, it doesn't sound so great at all. It sounds quite terrifying and invasive, but, you know, maybe that's how the relationship is formed if you're willing to and able to get through that fear. I think that's some great insight because this is such a mystery to me, having no real personal experience with these sorts of encounters, but I'm open to it. And I love to hear about what they say and what they do because it's as close as I can get to understanding what they're about. And that's really what I'm after.
Well, yeah. What this is about is a challenge to wake up to the existence of the soul while leaving behind all of the mythology associated with it and looking at it objectively as part of us. We want to think about, going to another planet and making starships and having cool interociters, or that's from that old movie, This Island Earth. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Love it.
Yeah. Anyway, and having this unfold on a very comprehensible physical level, that's not on the cards. That's not what's happening. And it never will happen that way. It's different. And once we get deeper into this, we're going to find out that this is stranger than anything we could possibly have imagined in the most exotic science fiction that we could create. And not only is it stranger, so are we.
Well said. Wow. Well, it really has been a pleasure to talk to you. I was, of course, 2 when Communion came out. No doubt your experiences have impacted the entire 90s era paranormal culture that I cut my teeth on. So I got to give it up to you for staying strong on these strange threads that weave our reality. And before we really call it in, do give the people some info on your website and any other projects you got going on, just so they can follow up.
Okay. My website is unknowncountry.com. I have 2 new books out, The Afterlife Revolution and a novel called New. And you just go Streber New on Amazon and you'll see the novel, Afterlife Revolution. It's easy to get on Amazon as well, or I guess wherever books are sold, although no self-respecting bookstore would stock Whitley Strieber, and that's why I don't have a publisher anymore. These are all published through my own company. The regular publishers will not publish Whitley Strieber anymore. There's been a tremendous hardening in the past 5 years. That's another story. We're getting ready to deploy a completely new website, and when we do, it will be once again possible to subscribe. We were derailed because the new website, just before it was going to be deployed, was hit with a massive malware attack and destroyed. And I now have a GoFundMe. So if you go to GoFundMe Strieber and please do this and give me a little bit of cash, because we lost years of work in this and it can be restored. It's not impossible, but it's not cheap either. And, you know, I am constantly under pressure, under attack. It never ends, and it never will as long as I'm alive. And then after I'm dead, I can assure you the debunkers will come out of the woodwork to try to make the truths that I have brought into this world, that we are a much bigger and more extraordinary race of beings than we dare imagine, and that we have a place in the universe waiting for us if we only dare to take our place. They will try to shove that all aside and say to you, you are small, you're insignificant, you are just a physical body, you have no soul, buy more cars, buy more hamburgers, and in the end, this will all settle down to darkness. I urge you to say no to that. Go for the light.
Cheers to that. And it's a shame to hear about your troubles, but again, very thankful to have you here. You live one hell of a life, and The Afterlife Revolution is a brave and emotional move to push this stuff even further. So thanks so much for putting yourself out there. Again, tell Anne I said thanks as well, and both of you, take care out there.
Thank you.
And the gods have granted gifts of glorious bounty today, good people. A legend in this space, and that one, the great Whitley Strieber. I felt good about this show. I felt like it was a bit of a get for me in terms of guest star power. I've been going to a lot of obscure places lately to get guests, and this is just the opposite, a name that likely every listener knows. And Whitley is just a great storyteller. And it can't be easy to constantly highlight the lost love of your life, but I appreciate the insight that he is able to share. You know, when someone has a new book out, and especially when it's so personal, that is what you're going to be talking about most of the time. But for Whitley to have had these contact experiences and also have this weird secret school aspect in his background, now that to me is the most interesting aspect of his life. So of course, the first hour is largely about the new book, Whitley's contact with his late wife, and the insights that he has into the big picture when folding in all these unique experiences. And then the plus show, that is when I could open it up and get really weird, and we talked about things like Whitley's insight into conscious computers and the Master of the Key saga, as well as the secret school and military intelligence connections to high strangeness events, and a deeper dive into Annie's insights about many things, including time, that she has from the other side. So if you liked the first hour, sign up for THC Plus and get the full interview, that extra hour, of not only this show, but what is now about 4 years worth of Plus Show archives. Sign up at the HiresideChatsPlus.com, always action-packed and commercial-free. So yeah, kind of just the nature of the show, but for the Plus people, I did love his AI comments. I thought they were pretty unique, and the secret school stuff is just so wild. Whitley can obviously talk a lot, so I really needed to be careful with my words. Maybe should have been more careful. But what I was getting at about the Skull and Bones researcher that he referenced in the past was that she played for him a really creepy sound of torturous, horrifying screaming, which she claimed was taped at one of the Skull and Bones rituals or at something that they are forced to listen to during their initiations. And Whitley had said that that sound reminded him of something that he had to hear at this secret school program from his childhood. Very creepy. And something I didn't get to bring up that relates to a facility in Monterrey, Mexico. He talked today largely about these experiences in San Antonio, but if you read the book or listen to older interviews, he talks about remembering this recruitment for a school in Monterrey, Mexico for gifted children. And if you remember the story of the Finders cult, I think many guests have brought it up over the years, but most recently John Brisson in his Plus Show portion. But the guys who were transporting these kids and got caught, apparently they said they were taking them to a school for gifted children in Mexico. And I find that really eerie. Why such cross-contamination between entity experiencers and military intelligence? I think it's too broad to say, well, it's all military fuckery and they just make you believe you had weird experiences. No. Because I think military intelligence, for the most part, is carrying out its own exploration of these entities, or consciousness, or other realms, whatever. And they just seem to use kids to do that. Maybe they've isolated certain factors that correlate to higher paranormal experiences. Maybe just being a kid is one of those. And then they try to get these kids into some program, call it something for gifted kids, stroke mom and dad's ego a bit, and then soul crack 'em Stranger Things style. So my best guess, and it is a guess, is not that these experiences are due to what we would just call that secret military program type aspect, but more that they recognize something in Whitley that maybe made them want to tag him or something to watch later. It's really hard to say because it's not like he's been interrogated at some black site post-communion, as far as I know. And that's the thing, we wouldn't know, we might not know. But I bet his book Communion was on a lot of CIA shelves in the late 80s and 90s. His insights from Annie are also really interesting, and I actually listened to the audiobook of this one, which Whitley narrates himself, and I did get choked up a time or two.
That sort of loss is something that anyone should empathize with. It's also interesting that Whitley says he knows nothing about psychedelics, and maybe that's more my realm of knowledge, but everything Annie says about the afterlife is very much in line with the couple of level 10 psychedelic experiences that I have had. Of these things that she has said, one of the main ones, I don't think it came up in the show, but I definitely jotted it down, was that when you're out of your body, it's not the, whoa, holy shit, what the hell's happening to me, type of reaction that you might expect. At least it wasn't for me. I'd never been consciously out of body, and when it happened, it was not surprising or disorienting at all. I was shockingly comfortable with it. In fact, it would be fair to say I felt more myself than I ever have. It was like I shed the clunky body that I try to operate and express myself through, never knowing what to do with my hands. But it's like I'm only operating this machine. And in that moment, it was very much like, ah, now I can stretch out a bit. Now I am unequivocally me. And I didn't really care if I came back. In fact, I sort of stopped doing salvia because I was having diminishing returns in terms of the contact. Never as powerful as the first time. But also, I sort of got sad when I came back. And I think I freaked out my now wife a couple of times by how excited I was to stay over there. And it really did feel like I didn't have to come back. And that's weird because it's not like a lot of people all over the place are doing salvia and then some of them are just dying and not coming back. Everybody's coming back. So to have this feeling that it was a choice obviously is not exactly right. It's a weird type of thought, and it sounds kind of dumb even coming out of my mouth now, because why would being a formless drop in an eternal ocean be appealing? None of it makes sense. But to me, this after-death contact with Anne seems very legit, because a few very foreign ideas that went through my head also seem to be what she's reporting back as well. And I think it'd be hard to nail those things if this wasn't genuine contact. Wouldn't be impossible, but it would be difficult. But I have to say, a lot of times doing a show like this can start to feel routine, but I was a bit giddy when I got off the phone with Whitley. Just super happy to say, boom, that just happened. I got it recorded. We're not gonna get a cancellation here. It's done. I try not to get too excited until I can actually say that. And I should really thank Laurel Erica here. If you remember the metaphysical Mother Goose from a few months ago, we talked to her about her knowing Whitley, and I asked her to put in a good word for me, and she did. So it wouldn't have happened if we didn't have that show as well. So sometimes we play the long game, and the bounty is sweet. But that does it for the month of June, a pretty all-over-the-place month, which are my favorites. Dr. Michael Sala, David Griffin, Ross Benn, Jordan Sather, and now Whitley Strieber. I give my Guest of the Month awards to Ross Benn and Whitley, but I really liked them all for their own reasons. I've already gotten a couple dozen plus cancellations over Jordan's show. People aren't shy about telling me that. How could you have an alt-right Trump lapdog on your show? Well, we're in strange times, guys. I think I said this in a wrap-up earlier in the month, but it's like you gotta choose a side between trusting the media and trusting the administration, because they are at odds. I like to say fuck them all, that's my choice. But people who are venomously against the administration are usually taking their talking points from the media. And the media has an agenda and also lies to us. So maybe you shouldn't use those arguments just because they prop up your position. I'm not saying the administration is good. Also, a bunch of crooks and liars, and they want to tell you, don't trust the media, that's all bullshit. Well, it is all bullshit. So you have two camps, which I think are actually divided, and they're both trying to manipulate the way you think. So don't give me a list of reasons that you hate the current administration that you got from CNN. Don't tell me why Anderson Cooper told you you should be mad at the administration, because I don't care about that. I brought Jordan here so we could get that clear understanding of what this QAnon position is. And we talked about many interesting pieces of news that I don't think have a whole lot to do with being a Trump supporter. I think the stuff about the veterans on patrol findings and the celebrity suicides were well worth the price of admission last week. And if you're going to cancel just because we go there with someone who holds an alt-right perspective once or a couple of times, I don't know what to say. I'm sure I got some signups to counterbalance the cancellations, but the problem for me, depending on this show, would be, so I want to explore this QAnon thing once or twice. I lose a few dozen longtime members over how much they hated it. I then get a few dozen people who sign up because of how much they loved it. And now, when the latter group realizes that I'm not a full-on QAnon alt-right show, they will drop off. So now I'm incentivized to please voices that I don't necessarily agree with, because the longtime loyalists are just that offended. It's really the flat earth all over again. I wanted to look at it, have some guests on to make that case. It is provocative and entertaining. And people who thought it went too far, they dropped off. And they were replaced by listeners who would ask for all flat earth all the time. And that's not great either. I need listeners who are open to pivoting and checking out all kinds of different things. So I guess I would just ask that longtime listeners realize that we try to get all sorts of voices, and if you just stick with me through the ones that you strongly disagree with, I won't be boxed in to have to cater to those singularly focused types of listeners. Oh well, do what you want. I know I will. But another month in the can, and I can also announce that the third and final installment of the Armenia tour with Graham Hancock is now out for Plus members. We go through Karahunj, which is Armenia's Stonehenge. We check out a way-off-the-radar ancient site they're calling the City of Knowledge, where I touched my first human bones, which were just scattered about in a pit in the woods. Kind of a trip. So check that out if you are one of those fine, sweet, glorious Plus members, and I'll see you next month. Big thanks to Whitley. I know a lot of people are after his time. I'm glad he gave us some of it. That's it for me. Your move, visitors from beyond the veil, Alphabet Agency, Esoteric Explorers, and Dean of the Secret School. Your fucking move.
Oh no, you see, the world isn't random, it's attached to puppet strings. Control over everything. The 9 to 5 is trying to steal ya. Now don't that job seem silly? Hello, can you hear me? Or should I play back recordings from some spy agency? Wish we were younger and free. I'll be thankful when it's all exposed, the vast conspiracy. There's such a difference between us and the damned rock. Sorry. that's good and well. Did you ever hear the argument that nothing really happens? It's no secret that the best is plus. It's doubling your time.